I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. In 2006, just a few days after Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was taken captive by Hamas, Gershon Baskin received an unusual phone call. It was from an economist he had met at a conference in Cairo who happened to be a member of Hamas. That was the start of back-channel negotiations between representatives of the Israeli government, Hamas leadership, and Baskin. Shalit was released last year in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. Gershon Baskin joins us on Radio Times to talk about what happened behind those scenes, the future of peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians, and the ongoing unrest in the Middle East. He's founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, and he has his own radio show on peace, All for Peace Radio, and his show is called At the Crossroads. And Gershon Baskin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. How is Gilad Shalit doing?
He's actually doing quite well now. He's got his strength back. He's gained some weight. He's been under psychological care of the Israeli army, who've taken really good care of him. I saw him a month after he was released, and he was really post-traumatic. It was really
post-traumatic.
It was really distressing to see him. The most obvious and evident manifestation of his captivity is that for 5 years and 4 months, he didn't have sunlight, which created extreme vitamin D deficiency, which creates clinical depression. In fact, the last 2 months of his captivity, he stopped eating out of clinical depression. It wasn't a hunger strike. They couldn't get him to eat. And probably if he had been in captivity another 2 months, he would have died.
And how about his family?
His family is doing quite well. I mean, after moving from being a very quiet, anonymous kind of family living in a village in the north of Israel, they became the center stage of Israel every single day for 5.5 years. And they're seeking to go back to some form of anonymity. Aviva Shalit, the mother of Noam, has said it very, very well a couple of days after he was released. He said, Gilad had become the child of every Israeli family. I want him to become my child once again.
And you think that will happen, knowing, of course, how much focus there was on this incident?
Well, I think that he's been out of the media. The press in Israel, the media, cooperated in not reporting his every movement. The first few days, they were reporting he went outside, he rode a bicycle, he talked this, he ate that, and the family asked them to give us space. So he's been out of the media. I was in Barcelona a couple of weeks ago coming at a conference and came back, and there was a football game, a soccer game in Barcelona between Barcelona and Real Madrid. And some Israelis who had gone to the game identified me, and they said, you're the Gilad Shalit guy, right? They said, where is he? Why hasn't he talked to us yet?
You said this is the most important thing you've ever done.
So far.
So far.
Yes.
In that you were almost by accident, because you got this phone call from someone, an economist that you had met at Cairo. Had you ever, in your life, ever had contact or conversation with someone from Hamas?
No, I hadn't. This was the first contact I had with Hamas. Although my involvement, I say, actually began about a year before the abduction of Gilad Shalit. One of my wife's first cousins was abducted by Hamas. He was a civilian, and he had Palestinian friends, and he was drawn to Ramallah to see some factory equipment that he was buying and selling, and he never came home. And
what happened to him?
Well, I went to Ramallah. I sent Palestinian friends to ask where he might be if people had heard about him. About 3 days later, Hamas issued a videotape showing him handcuffed and blindfolded and all bloody. About 3 days after that, they found his body. He was butchered. He was murdered. And I felt helpless. Here, I'm a peace activist. I've been involved with Palestinians for 25 years. I know everyone in Palestine, and I couldn't do anything to help save my wife's cousin. And when I got this phone call from the professor from the Islamic University of Gaza, the Hamas guy, and said, Gershon, we got to do something because our lives are becoming hell in Gaza as a result of the kidnapping of Shalit.
There was shelling.
I said, I will do anything possible to help save a human life.
And you call him Professor M. Have you ever identified who
Yeah, his name is Mohammed Migdad. Initially, I called him Professor M because he had actually come to a conference that we helped organize in Ankara with Israelis, and when he got back to Gaza, he had lost his job. He was put on suspension for a year from his position at the Islamic University for going to a conference with Israelis.
Hmm. And had he ever had contact or even talked to an Israeli before?
No. I was at this UN conference in Cairo on Palestine, And I was introduced to him by a common friend from Gaza. He had traveled from Gaza to Cairo with the explicit purpose of meeting an Israeli. He thought there might be Israelis there. And I was the first Israeli he ever met, the first Jew he had ever spoken to. And he was the first Hamas person I had ever spoken to.
And do you consider him a friend today?
I don't know if we're friends. My counterpart in Hamas, who I ended up negotiating with over a period of more than 5 years, I would call him a friend, Razi Hamad, who's a senior Hamas official. He's actually the deputy foreign minister of the Hamas government in Gaza. I haven't had much contact with Mohammed Miqdad after that. After he had lost his job, he sort of cut contacts, and I understood where that was coming from.
So this first phone call is, we have to do something. What was that something?
Well, he thought that we needed to open up a line of communication, was exactly right. He went to the office of the Hamas prime minister. I got a phone call from the Hamas prime minister's director general, and that opened up the process that eventually became the formal official negotiating track. After 5 years of pleading with the Israeli government to listen to me, saying, I have contact with the people who are holding Shalit.
And this Ghazi Hamad, this was really your contact person, and he was a spokesperson for the prime minister.
He was a spokesperson for the prime minister, advisor to the government. About a year later, after Hamas had won the elections, he wrote a critical article in one of the Hamas newspapers saying, what are we doing? What's our direction? Who are we? What's our strategy? And he paid with his job for that article of being critical about Hamas. About 2 years later, he was given a new job, which became critical for the negotiations for Shalit because he became the liaison between the Hamas government and the Hamas military for borders crossings, which essentially means the tunnels, the underground economy of Gaza. And that put him in firsthand contact with the strongman of Hamas, the person who heads the Ezzedine al-Qassam. This is the military wing of Hamas, someone named Ahmed Jabri, who was the person holding Shalit. And Razi Hamad and Jabri, who Razi used to call Mr. J., was the link that enabled us to have a direct line of communication to the people holding Shalit.
Well, and interestingly, you had a friend, the daughter of Ehud Olmert.
Right.
You were, in a sense, using her, not using in a bad way, but using her...
She was the conduit.
As a go-between to try to get to Olmert.
Right. When I turned to her and asked her if she would transmit messages from Hamas to her father, the prime minister, she said, of course I would, but she also cautioned me and said, he's not going to listen. She's told me that my father doesn't like Arabs, and of all the Arabs he likes least are the Palestinians. But more than that, the people he trusts least in the world are Israelis who have contact with Palestinians.
Interesting.
So I knew Olmert from before. We had been in contact from different positions that he were in. We were obviously political adversaries, but this was not an issue of political adversary. This was an issue of saving an Israeli life, a soldier who had gone there. And trying to reach a deal as quickly as possible.
But was there also a policy of not negotiating with terrorists?
Well, that was the mantra that I got back from Dana Olmert with every phone conversation and every email from her, that Ehud Olmert said, we don't negotiate with terrorists, we won't release prisoners, we won't pay for information, and we know he's alive and we're holding Hamas responsible.
And a kind of a stalemate.
It was a stalemate. When I got the message from Olmert that we know he's alive, I said, that's all good and fine. Let's determine whether or not the channel of communication that I opened up actually leads to Shalit. It took 2.5 months, and I ended up producing a handwritten letter from Gilad Shalit that was delivered to the Egyptian representative office in Gaza and then delivered to the Israelis and the family, of course. And this proved that this connection was live. But the very next day, the person appointed by Olmert to be in charge of the case called me up and said, thank you. Now you're out of the picture. We don't need you. Because an official line of communication had opened up via the Egyptians at the time. But I was really suspicious of the Egyptians because the Egyptians were not interested in an agreement at this time. This was the government of Hosni Mubarak. He was not interested in empowering Hamas and strengthening the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. There was no way the Egyptians at that period were going to be effective negotiators.
But are you saying that Hamas was more willing to negotiate than Israel over Gilad Shalit?
Hamas told me for more than 5 years all the time, when Israel is serious, we will negotiate. We will be flexible. I always thought when they said we're willing to negotiate that meant when Israel gives in to our demands, that negotiation didn't really mean anything to them. I was wrong. In fact, when at the end of the process it became clear that my channel was the official channel and Israel was being serious. Mm. Hamas demonstrated flexibility in every category. Let's be clear here, though. The price they demanded was a very high price. That price of 1,000 to 1 was already set by December 2006, about 5 months after the abduction of Shalit, 4 months. That deal, the framework deal, was made already less than half a year after the abduction.
So what took 5 years? Why did it take so long?
That's a very good question. That's one of the questions that I ask all the time. Why did this have to take so long? And the reason was because Israel was not really willing to negotiate. Olmert certainly wasn't. At the end of his administration, Netanyahu, who had been elected, asked Olmert to finish this. Don't leave this on my table. And Olmert refused to make the deal. The fear was how many Israelis would pay with their lives because of one Israeli soldier. This is what held back the agreement for so long.
But I'm also looking at a letter that you wrote to Khaled Mashal. This was in January 2007, expressing what sounds like your frustration with the Palestinians. I once again want to stress that it's time to complete the deal for the release of Shalit. Enough. It's time to complete the prisoner exchange.
What I was trying to say to Hamas also is look at the price you guys are paying. One of the things that I point out to Palestinians now when they talk about the victory that they achieved in releasing 1,027 prisoners for one Israeli soldier is that in that same time period, 3,000 Palestinians in Gaza were killed. If this is a victory, then they need to rethink their strategy. And in fact, Hamas has said in the aftermath that they are not planning to kidnap any more soldiers. There's a recognition, at least by part of the leadership, that the price was too high for them to pay.
I was also, though, reading that of the Palestinian prisoners, the more than 1,000 that were released, and they, quote-unquote, blood on their hands, the deaths of something like 600 Israelis, thousands of Israelis wounded as a result of these people's actions.
The deal was 450 prisoners released by a list submitted by Hamas that was negotiated. Of those 450, 94% of them had killed Israelis.
Does that seem like a fair swap?
No, it's not a fair swap. The decision-making at the end of the day, both by Netanyahu and the heads of the security establishment in Israel, was not to look backwards, but to look forward. The assessment was made, to what extent are these people going to danger Israel's security? And the deal that Hamas agreed to in the end was that the most dangerous people by the Israeli security assessment were deported, either deported to Gaza or deported abroad, lessening the chance that they would do something against Israelis. Those who are allowed to return to the West Bank have to check in, depending upon who they are, between once a day and three times a week to Palestinian police. And in fact, something that's not very well known, last week, one of the prisoners who didn't check into the Palestinian police station was rearrested by the Israelis.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Gershom Baskin today on Radio Times, founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post. He has a radio show, in Israel, and he is talking to us about the kind of back-channel negotiations that he was involved with, helped to set up between the Israeli government and Hamas, and it led to the release of Gilad Shalit in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo. To celebrate the Cherry Blossom Festival with the Japan American Society, Dr. Hamada from Villanova and I will present a tutorial luncheon in my Wayne restaurant on Sunday, February 26th. Margaret Kuo's restaurants support WHYY.
There is no purchase necessary for the Newsworks.org Facebook sweepstakes. You may only enter online with your own email address. You must like Newsworks on Facebook to enter. You must be 21 years or older and a resident of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or Delaware. WHYY employees, affiliates, freelancers, and members of their families are not eligible. Entrants given WHYY permission to use their name on Newsworks social media and website as a winner. One entry per person per week. Bonus entries given for people who share with others on Twitter and or Facebook who then like Newsworks on Facebook. Odds of winning depend upon the number of entries received. One winner will be drawn at random per week and will be notified at the email address provided. Prize values vary. Conditions for certain prizes apply. Prizes are not exchangeable or redeemable for cash. WHYY is not responsible for entries that are not filled in correctly. Void where prohibited by law.
When I was about your age, I was making some real stupid decisions and some stupid calls that was causing me blood on my hands and my head. Stop.
On the next Fresh Air, Amina Matthews talks about being a former gang member who now works to stop gang violence. She's profiled in the documentary The Interrupters, which will be shown on Frontline. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Gershon Baskin about the key role that he played negotiating the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who was captured and held by Hamas for 5 years. He was released in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What I find so fascinating about the story is not just the role that you played, but we've also got a member of the Mossad. Mm-hmm. We also have the Egyptian government, in a sense, involved. Germans are involved as well. All this happening, in a sense, behind the scenes.
The whole world wanted to get involved and wanted to help. The German mediator who came in was a German intelligence officer who successfully negotiated the deal for the two kidnapped soldiers in Lebanon. That led to the beginning of the Second Lebanon War. They, of course, came back in coffins. But a deal had been worked out through the German mediator, and after it became clear to the Israelis that the Egyptians were no longer in the game, Hamas had conducted its coup d'etat in Gaza in June of 2007 and closed their office in Gaza, the Israelis asked the German mediators to come in. The German government, Angela Merkel, committed a huge amount of resources to this, and the German mediator, Dr. Conrad, Gerhard Conrad, had made more than 50 visits to Israel and to Gaza in trying to mediate it. In my assessment, at the end of the day, there was such a huge cultural gap between the German mediator and the Hamas people that it led to a failure of the deal. He showed up in December 2009 with a 150-page proposed agreement. The Hamas people looked at this and said, this guy's working for the Israelis. Mm. I mean, he maybe thought he was doing a merger between two giant German corporations and not a prisoner exchange. A 150-page document with 15 annexes. The Hamas couldn't deal with it. So the German mediation stopped, and then nothing was left, and they finally came to me.
So what was the most nerve-wracking part of this whole long-term negotiation?
What was nerve-wracking for me was hearing all the time from the Shalit family, from the Hamas people, and from contacts I had in the Israeli government that nothing was happening. I wondered to myself, there's a whole Israeli team working on this. What do they do every day? I was consumed by this 24/7. I was thinking all the time, reaching out. I spoke to Syrians. I spoke to Germans and Russians and Turks and Norwegians and everyone I could to try and help resolve this issue. And I was thinking all the time, what are the officials who are in charge of this doing every day? It just didn't make sense to me why it was going on for so long.
So was there a breakthrough? I mean, clearly the exchange took place, Gilad Shalit was released, but was there a breakthrough moment?
There were two breakthrough moments in my mind. One was when Netanyahu appointed the new guy to be in charge, named David Maidan. From the Mossad, the rank of general in Mossad. And after he cleared his desk from what had been done in the past and came to his team and said, we have nothing. What about this guy, Gershon Baskin, who keeps coming to us with information that he has a contact? People on his team said, no, he's a peacenik, he's a lefty, he's a pinko, you know, we don't have to listen to him. And David Maidan turned to his team and said, has anyone in this room spoken to him? And no one had. So he said, I'm going to check it out. And he started asking me to deliver messages to the Hamas. I delivered the message and got back answers within an hour. And that blew them away because for years, they've been trying to get messages directly to the guys holding Shalit, and it would take days, weeks, and sometimes months before they got answers. And here, within an hour, they were getting answers. They started listening through the intelligence service and discovered that the messages were coming right from the source. And that blew them away. So that was a breakthrough moment. In May of 2011, I came home and said to my wife, I'm bringing Gilad Shalit home. Mm. This was a sense that once they were listening to me, I knew that we could do it. And the second breakthrough was on July 14th when Razi Hamad, my counterpart, and I finally managed to produce a declaration of principles for the agreement that for the first time, Hamas used the word finality, closure, what it is that will close the deal for them. And they showed their willingness to compromise in all the categories of prisoners.
So being a peace nick,
yes.
A peace activist was a liability as far as the Israeli government was
concerned? Well, it certainly is today. First of all, the peace movement in Israel was decimated after the Second Intifada when Palestinians were attacking Israel with suicide bombers inside of Israel proper, and the peace movement lost its credibility in the eyes of the public. And many people in the peace camp today are considered what's called post-Zionist or anti-Zionist, or people support the boycott Israel movement. I'm not. I'm a Zionist. I'm an Israeli citizen. And I always considered myself loyal to Israel. I think that making peace is in Israel's best interest as a Jewish Zionist state. And I'm probably not the mold of the normal average peace activist in Israel today. I think I'm rather mainstream, but it's difficult once you have that label and you're boxed in this category for people to take you seriously.
But did you think that you were negotiating with the enemy when you were negotiating with members of Hamas?
No
Is that how you saw
it? No doubt about it. I mean, one of the things that enabled Razi Haman and I to become a team, a mediating team, was that we made a conscious decision not to talk politics.
Hmm. Was that hard to do?
No, we focused on Gilad Shalit and the prisoner exchange. And the fact that I felt from him some kind of compassion toward the Shalit family made it easier for me to do that.
Let me get Avi from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Avi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Sharon. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
My question will be, actually, regards all the families that saw all those terrorists getting out to the free world and giving a second chance. How does families supposed to feel that they saw all those thousand terrorists mm-hmm. getting out of the prison after murdering their own family? How are they supposed to feel?
Well, that's a fair
question.
Tell
you,
go ahead.
You know, my wife's cousin, who I talked about earlier, who was killed by Hamas, the person who killed him was released in the deal as well. And on the day that the deal was announced and the Israeli government voted 26-3 in favor of the deal, based on the recommendation of the heads of the security establishment in Israel, the head of the Mossad, the head of the Shin Bet, the chief of staff of the army, and the government supported it, I got a phone call from Ronit, my wife's cousin's wife, who yelled at me for more than half an hour saying, how could you do this? The murder of Sasson, my wife's cousin, spent less than 6 years in prison. He was a brutal butcher. He killed my wife's cousin with a butcher knife. I mean, it wasn't shooting him or blowing him up in a bus. He with his own hands killed him, and he was released in the deal. I think it's a tragic reality that we live in, that people like that had to be released to save Gilad Shalit. And I think it's very difficult for the families. But I know a lot of families of victims of terrorism who said, if we can save Gilad Shalit, if we can bring this soldier home alive, we can't save the people who were killed. They're already gone. But we're talking about a human life. We're talking about an Israeli soldier. And you know very well, as an Israeli, that our army is a people's army. I have a son in the army now. If we didn't bring Gilad Shalit home, I, as a parent in Israel, would have difficulty sending my son to the army, knowing that the country is not willing to pay those kind of prices to save every single one of our children.
Avi, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. When you think, though, about an exchange of one person, almost no matter who that person is, for 1,000. It seems so
unbalanced.
Unbalanced, exactly.
You know, one of the Hamas negotiators, the person who was responsible for creating the network of Hamas terrorism in the West Bank, the Yazid al-Qassam forces, named Salah Arouri, was one of the negotiators for the deal from the Hamas side. He was interviewed 2 weeks after the deal was made on Israeli radio in Hebrew. And Mr. Arouri said, this is the bizarre nature of our society, of our situation. He said, I have real admiration for Israeli society that we're willing to pay $1,027 for one. I wish that we valued the lives of our fighters as much as Israel did. This coming from a Hamas guy, I think it's very interesting.
And that's Gershom Baskin, our guest today on Radio Times, a founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post. He has a radio show on All for Peace Radio. And joining us today on Radio Times to talk about the role that he played in the release of Gilad Shalit in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. We do want to talk about the prospects for peace between Israelis and Palestinians and the ongoing unrest in the Middle East as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. How would you describe Hamas today?
What I've learned about Hamas is what I didn't know before, is that Hamas is first and foremost a Palestinian national political movement with an Islamic flavor, undertones, overtones of religious fanaticisms, and perhaps, but as a political movement and not as a religious movement, it is willing to change. And those changes are happening rather rapidly within the Hamas movement, which surprises me much more quickly than I expected. There are struggles, democratic struggles taking place within the Hamas movement, a demand for elections for their highest supreme ruling body, which is called the Shura Council, which has been a secret body. They want to hold elections for the Shura Council. Now, this is part of the so-called Arab Spring and the demand for more accountability. But we hear statements from Hamas leaders like Khaled Mashou have said, we're not going to have the armed struggle anymore. We're going to support a nonviolent resistance against the occupation, or people talking about a Palestinian state in the 67 borders, not a state from the river to the sea. So changes are taking place there.
You're saying that Hamas does not want the destruction of Israel as it has said in the past?
They have not changed their covenant. They have not changed their basic ideology. But they're becoming more pragmatic and facing the reality that they're not going to destroy Israel. And as I said, the struggle is within the movement today. Khaled Mashal, who's one of the important people, who said, our goal now is to establish a Palestinian state in the 67 borders, meaning West Bank and Gaza, not in all of Israel. He's not said we're willing to recognize Israel or make peace with Israel. He's not joined the Zionist movement. But there's a modicum now of some kind of pragmatism and compromise.
How would you describe, and I'm asking you a kind of a broad question here, but what life is like inside of Israel today?
Well, I think for the average Israeli, life is quite good. Quality of life is high. Israelis are happy to be Israelis. We have this part of an international survey on the extent that people are happy where they're living, and Israelis are way up at the top of the scale. So even though we have our social injustice problems and economic problems and war, and there's security today, the economy is growing. There's a sense of that the country is a good place to live.
And is that in part because of the wall that was built? I mean, has that helped to provide security for Israel?
Yeah, but the wall is only one part of it. The real reason why there are no suicide bombers today is because Palestinian society made a decision to stop it. For tactical reasons and also for moral reasons. If they wanted to continue to kill Israelis, they would find ways to do it even with a wall.
Let me get, looks like Gary from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Gary, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, it's a very interesting show.
Thank you.
I want to ask your guest if he thinks that this deal indicates at least a possibility of small chance of improvement of the relationship with Hamas in the future.
And so thank you.
I'll take this off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary, for calling in.
It's a good question. September, when we were doing the negotiations, the end of August, there was a terrorist attack that took place over the Sinai, and 8 Israelis were killed, and Israel went and killed Palestinians who they thought were responsible for it. And we worked out, after 3 days of intensive negotiations, a ceasefire. Neither side was willing to announce the ceasefire. This shows that we're not willing to recognize each other. We're not willing to talk to each other. In the aftermath of the Shalit exchange, the prisoner exchange, Hamas talked to me about trying to formalize and institutionalize a ceasefire. Again, they're not willing to do it through direct negotiations. We have to involve the Egyptians in doing it. But there seems to be the willingness on both sides to try and find out some way of establishing a longer-term ceasefire arrangement. We're not talking about peace negotiations. We're talking about a modus vivendi to live together without killing each other.
Let me get Kyle from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Kyle, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I just wanted to mention, because I feel like it might have been slightly left behind, is that we're still dealing with an illegal occupation of Palestine. And a military target is a military target. I mean, it's faced numerous UN rebukes that has been, you know, vetoed by the United States. Just the general occupation. So I just wanted to mention that and just show that, you know, that a military target is different than holding hundreds of teenagers in Israeli prisons. And that's just my point.
Okay, fair enough. Let me give our guests a chance to respond. Go ahead, Gershon.
I agree that the occupation is something that we have to end. I, as an Israeli, don't want to occupy another people and deny them the right to self-determination, to live in freedom and justice in their own state. And a military target is different from a civilian target, and Gilad Shalit was a soldier. Which is why, in the end of the day, Israel negotiated with Hamas to free an Israeli soldier. And you're right. This is a situation which is not sustainable, and we want to end it.
How would you describe the and I'm using quotations on the radio here, the peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians?
There are no real peace negotiations going on. The talks that are taking place with the great help of King Abdullah II of Jordan are important because we have to continue talking. I know of no case in the world where peace has ever been made by not talking. So it's important that Israelis and Palestinians talk, but there is a recognition that there won't be an agreement through a public peace process. I met with President Abbas last Tuesday, and we talked about those negotiations, and he agreed to me, with me that there's zero chance of negotiating in public for an agreement. Both Abbas and Netanyahu are negotiating over their shoulders to their own public and not negotiating with each other. There needs to be a secret back channel.
I want to quote something you actually wrote to King Abdullah. This was 2 years ago, February 2010, and I'll just quote a couple of lines here. You wrote, "The great hopes that we had for President Obama have been unrequited, and we are left with the reality that the international community will not save us from ourselves. We cannot afford to wait for the next round of violence that could change the reality for the worse on the ground. We must have some other form of intervention that could be useful. We must have a different mediator and a different mediated process." And you express your frustration with George Mitchell and, and the sort of talks about the talks that had gone on.
Right. There were great hopes. I had great hopes for President Obama. He said something that no other president had ever said about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on his second day in office. He said, "The resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a U.S. national security interest." For me, that meant if it's a U.S. national security interest, the Israelis and the Palestinians no longer have a veto on a deal, because this is U.S. interest, particularly when U.S. had troops in the Middle East fighting. President Obama understood it, and he appointed George Mitchell with very good intentions, the senior statesman with experience and success in Northern Ireland. But George Mitchell got it wrong from the first day, and he spent 2 years negotiating negotiations rather than negotiating substance. And I pleaded with him and his team to begin a negotiating process through mediation without the Israelis and Palestinians sitting in the same room. You didn't need them to be sitting in the same room because George Mitchell was a mediator. We'd never had a mediator before, and a mediator is a very powerful position if you know how to use it. He abused the power, I think.
Well, let me follow up on that. Are you talking about, well, first of all, how did he abuse the power?
Because he focused on process rather than substance. He could have done what Jimmy Carter had done in the first Camp David. Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat never talked to each other in Camp David. The American team went back and forth between Begin and Sadat, and Jimmy Carter and his team drafted the agreement. This is what George Mitchell should have been doing. He should have started drafting agreement on borders, on security, on Jerusalem, on refugees. A single text agreement that would have gone back and forth between the two parties until they're willing to sit in the room. But he spent 2 years trying to just get them into the room. That was a waste of time.
But literally the idea of having, you know, Palestinians here, Israelis here, a doorway in between, and a negotiator, mediator running back and forth.
Exactly. That's what should have been done. Essentially, that's what Lazi Haman and I did as a team with the Israelis and the Palestinians, who refused to talk to each other. We talked to each other, and then we talked to the two sides.
We're almost up in a break here, but does the U.S. then have any role to play?
Not now. We're in a presidential campaign. The American candidates are falling over their feet, claiming who's a better friend of Israel, and that does not allow for a... We're not even talking about an impartial mediator, but an effective mediator. America can't play a mediating role today.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Gershon Baskin, and he is founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post. He has a radio show called At the Crossroads for All for Peace Radio. It's actually broadcast on the internet, and we are talking about the role that he played in the release of Gilad Shalit, and we're also talking about the prospects for peace in the Middle East, and of course the ongoing unrest as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by MacArthur Theater in Princeton, presenting The Convert, a new play by Denai Gurira, directed by Emily Mann through February 12th. A tale of heritage, history, and faith in 1890s Africa, The Convert is the story of a young girl forced to choose between her family's traditions and the Christian faith and Western values she has embraced. Tickets at 609-258-2787 or at MacArthur.org. MacArthur Theater in Princeton proudly supports WHYY.
Hi, I'm Dave Davies. You've made the choice to listen to WHYY, and we're committed to making it the best experience possible. Your support allows WHYY the time to tell the full story, so you hear reliable, in-depth news coverage. This is only possible with your support. We're trying to wrap up our winter membership campaign, but we need to hear from you now to reach our goal. Please visit WHYY.org or call 1-888-345-9499 to show your support.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. There are lots of books about fathers and sons bonding over sports, but now a father, a sports reporter, tells of connecting with his daughters through the games they play. Also, we'll take an extended listen to Adele, who's expected to rule at this weekend's Grammys. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Gershon Baskin, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You and I were talking during the break, and we've had a number of guests on the show talking about the peace negotiations and the back and forth. And there seems to be consensus that everyone kind of knows what the solution or the resolution is.
Right.
The problem is getting there.
Right. This conflict is resolvable. Every single issue under negotiations is resolvable. We've been there. We've done it. We've been negotiating for 18 years. The officials know if there are draft agreements out there, everything can be resolved, and there's a lack of political will. And the lack of political will emerges from two things. One, a failed peace process. We did not implement, both sides did not implement what they obligated themselves to do in the past, and that makes it more difficult. And secondly, we've lost confidence that there's a partner for peace on the other side, and there's a mirror image of Israeli and Palestinian public opinion here. Both sides believe we want peace, but the other sides don't, and it makes it very difficult to do.
Do both sides also see themselves as the greater victim?
Of course, we love to be victims. We have a competition of who suffered more at whose hands. I have a friend who came up with this theory, against conflict resolution theory, that talks about win-win. He says in the Israeli-Palestinian situation, we need to have an agreement which is a lose-lose, and each side is convinced that the other side lost more.
Oh, and that would move things forward.
Perhaps, because it's all about honor.
Honor.
Meaning my national honor. You can't do something that's going to hurt. I have to stand taller than you at the end of the day.
Let me get some more callers in. Looks like we have Anne from Cherry Hill joining us on Radio Times.
Yes.
Go ahead, Anne.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm interested in the two-state solution. I'm a supporter of it, but I'd like to know what your guest thinks. If there is no two-state solution, what will happen in Israel?
There is no solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict except the two-state solution. There's no such thing as a one-state solution if solution means end of conflict. One state means transforming a territorial conflict where the solution is partition into an identity conflict, which turns us into Bosnia. Bosnia went crazy because the Bosnian population made up of Bosniak Muslims, Croats, and Serbs could not divide their territory, and they fought an all-out war over whose identity is attached to the territory. In 4 years, 150,000 people were killed. We are on a time clock here with the viability of a two-state solution diminishing with the Palestinian moderate leadership that supports it going to be not there tomorrow or the day after. And then we're in big trouble. There is no other solution.
And thanks for calling into Radio Times. You are the founder of this Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information. How much contact is there between Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, in our center in IPCRI, there's contact every single day. We sit in the same office, Israelis and Palestinians. We organized, over the last 24 years, thousands of meetings between Israelis and Palestinians. But in the overall society, Israelis and Palestinians don't meet each other anymore. They don't talk to each other anymore. They don't work together. They don't play together. They don't do anything together. And this is the great disconnect. My children, who are of a different generation, came of age in the second intifada, in the age of suicide bombers, and if it weren't for me, they would have no contact with Palestinians, just like all of their friends. And this is the same on both sides. The one difference today, and we don't know its impact, is Facebook.
Social media.
There is contact in the social media, and I check it from time to time. I open up randomly people's pages to see if they have friends on the other side, and I'm so surprised of how many young Israelis and how many young Palestinians have some friends from the other side on their Facebook pages.
I was reading that you have two rules that guide your conversations. One is that you don't discuss Israel's right to exist.
Yes.
It's a given.
Yes.
But you also say that you will talk to anyone who wants to talk with you.
Right. As long as I'm sitting at a table and they're not pointing a gun at me, I'm willing to talk to anyone, which is different than, I think, what governments can do. There are rules for government engagement. There are the quartet conditions for Hamas of recognizing Israel, denouncing violence, and adhering to former agreements. I'm not limited by those doctrines. I'm a civil society activist. Mm. I will talk to anyone who's willing to talk to me and help to moderate the situation through those conversations.
And have you had lots of those conversations?
Throughout the years. I started when it was illegal to talk to the PLO. I broke the law openly and defiantly. I thought it was wrong not to talk to our enemy who we want to make peace with.
You have this show, and I will say correctly now, for All for Peace Radio. The name of your show is At the Crossroads. Right. It's an internet radio show.
Well, it's a broadcast on the FM radio. We're licensed by the Palestinian Authority on a frequency in Hebrew and in Arabic that was given by the Palestinian Authority under the Oslo Agreement. The Israeli government shut us down, the Hebrew frequency, 2 months ago after we'd been on the airwaves for 7 years. Because of the political messages of our show, and they're claiming we require a license from Israel, we took the case to the High Court in Israel, to the Supreme Court, and we're now waiting for an answer which should be delivered in the next couple of weeks, or whether or not we can broadcast once again on FM.
And what are those political messages?
We're a peace station. We talk about peace. Our message is peace. We're a pro-democracy station. We talk against the legislation, which is in the Israeli Knesset now, the anti-democracy legislation limiting freedom of speech, limiting the ability of non-governmental organizations to work, etc. And the government doesn't like our message.
Let me get, looks like Yoshi from Princeton to join our conversation. And Yoshi, go ahead. You're on, excuse me, on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is, when or why does Israel not lift the blockade on Gaza? This is ostensibly the reason that Israel, like Gilad Shalit, is ostensibly the reason why they tightened the blockade, even though it happened way before that.
Thanks, Yoshi, for calling. Go ahead.
I think it's a very good question, and I'm not sure that I have a very good answer to the question because I don't understand it either. There was an understanding. In fact, at the beginning of negotiations with Hamas, Israel talked about what the situation in Gaza would be after Gilad Shalit is no longer there, and the messages I gave to Hamas from Israel were economic development projects and infrastructure projects, presumably lifting the siege. The siege has only partially been lifted. It needs to continue the process, and I hope that we can link the negotiations on ceasefire to removing the siege entirely. There has to be a blockade of weapons. We can't allow Gaza to be the warehouse of weapons and rockets that can attack Israel, but economic activity should be allowed to be conducted freely.
Yoshi, thanks for calling. Let's see what Raj from Bryn Mawr has to say. Raj, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm not Jewish or I'm not Muslim. I'm from India. My point is, if Gandhi was trying to negotiate, have peace protest against a regime that did not value life, it would not have gone anywhere. He would be dead. So my question is, the guest said that the Palestinian negotiators said the Palestinians don't value life like Jewish, like Israel values life. How do you negotiate when you think this, the other side doesn't value life? How can you take peace there?
Or values life in a different kind of way?
I think it's a mistake to think that people don't value life. I think it's a mistake to take the few examples of Palestinian mothers who said they're happy to send their children to be martyrs, to be suicide bombers. They are not representative of the broad cross-section of Palestinian society. Every Palestinian mother values the life of their children in the same way that every Jewish mother does. And I don't buy it that there's a difference in the value of life. There was a difference in the value, the attached value in this negotiation, but we were not talking about how many people were being killed. We're talking about how many people were being freed from prison. There's a difference in value of life.
Raj, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me just expand our conversation and talk about what looks like in Syria. I'm not going to call it a civil war, but certainly moving in that direction.
It is a civil war.
A little closer than I am. Well, how do you understand what's going on there, and what effect do you think it's going to have on the region?
Well, I think it's total brutality and unacceptable in any human standards, and it's a tragedy that the international community is not intervening in a way that would be more effective. And the main reason for that is the cynical nature of international politics. Syria has no oil. It's not Libya.
There are sanctions, though.
There are sanctions.
And there has been condemnation.
That's right, but that's not enough. This brutality, this killing has to be stopped. Bashar al-Assad is massacring his people. And this cannot be accepted. Hundreds of people, thousands of people have been killed. The Bashar al-Assad regime has killed more Syrians than have been killed by Israel in five or six wars. This cannot continue. His regime is his days are numbered, and the international community has to let that message be known. It's not even a point where he can correct his behavior and reform. This regime has to go.
But do you see him like Gaddafi and Libya?
Well, I think that he is going to be killed by his people or run away if he's smart enough to save himself. He tried to send his wife out, and the opposition caught him and prevented her from leaving, and I hope this is a signal that he himself is on his way out as well. The big question, of course, is going to happen what happens afterwards and this great instability there, and we don't know what kind of regime will develop, but in the face of evil, you need to fight evil.
What do you think of the Arab Spring, again, broadly speaking?
My heart and my mind was with those people in Tahrir Square in Cairo. I was glued to my television set and praying for their success and was inspired by their courage in fighting for freedom, liberty, and dignity and democracy. And I was happy to see the Mubarak regime go. It's very worrisome to see what's going on in the region now, in Egypt in particular. The great challenge for Egypt is not even the writing of the new constitution, but feeding their people. Egypt's economy is based on tourism and foreign investment, which has gone down to zero since the revolution. And this will create great suffering and challenges for whatever emerges in Egypt in the future.
Does it threaten Israel?
It does. I don't think the peace treaty itself is threatened, but the Sinai Desert has turned into a lawless zone, and this is the buffer between Israel and Egypt. There's Al-Qaeda there. There's a great amount of weapons that have come from Libya into Sinai. The Bedouins who live there have turned into gangs and marauders and have created a kind of internal terrorism inside of Sinai. It's a dangerous place right now.
Well, let me talk about another dangerous situation, which, of course, is Iran.
Mm-hmm.
There are, again, sanctions against Iran. There are threats of bombing its nuclear facilities. As a peace activist, how do you view what's going on in Iran and the regional and world reaction to that?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I have friends in Iran, and I was with some Iranians at a conference 2 weeks ago, and I'm very concerned about the situation. That's a crazy regime there who are working against their people, and unfortunately, they crushed the revolution there 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the Green Movement that tried to claim its victory in the elections, and I think they actually probably won the elections, but they didn't manage to do that. Iran cannot have a nuclear bomb, and it seems to me that they are intent in achieving one. And it's not out of fear that they're going to use it against Israel or use it against Saudi Arabia. I don't think they would use the bomb, but they're going to let loose an arms race in the region that the world cannot afford. The production of enriched uranium that will leak out to non-government, non-state actors and terrorist groups will endanger security all around the world, and this is something that the world, I don't think, knows how to stop. The sanctions might be effective, but maybe not effective enough. It seems to me that the government of Israel has made a decision that they're going to strike. I think they have a green light from Washington. I don't know when, to what extent they'll be successful and what the retaliation will be, but it seems to me that that decision has been made.
And do you favor that decision, as difficult and fraught as it is?
I have a difficult time saying I support that decision. On the other hand, I'm very concerned about what would happen if they don't do it. So it's a real big dilemma. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful at this point that I'm not a decision maker.
Fair enough. Let me get Yuri from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Yuri, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good morning.
I just wanted to make a couple of quick comments. Firstly, I live in Philadelphia with my wife. We're both Israeli Americans. My neighbor, two doors down, are Palestinian Americans. And basically, every day after school, our children play together in the backyard and inside our houses. And also, I wanted to say that I grew up in Israel in the 70s. And it was different. You know, back then Palestinians were able to come into Israel and work, and it seemed like there was a lot of individual dignity. Young men could wake up in the morning on both sides of the border and go to work and provide for their families and build a future. And I think that grassroots level should be encouraged more, you know, talked about more. The governments will follow, I think, if there's that grassroots economic reason to coexist. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, Urien. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Go ahead.
I agree with you, but with one point. In the 1970s, there was still an occupation as well, and Palestinians could work in Israel and had more dignity and more freedom than they have today under the current situation. But on the other hand, they were still living under occupation and wanted a state of their own and to be their own sovereign.
But what's interesting is Yuri came from Israel to this country. You left this country to live in Israel. What drew you to Israel?
I came of age as an activist in a Zionist youth movement at the same time that I was a political activist in America against the war in Vietnam and the civil rights movement, and I felt very much attached to Israel, that Israel is my home. I belong there. I had a drawing. I'm not a religious person, but it was kind of a spiritual, mystical drawing that brought me to Israel, and I felt at home there from the first time I visited at the age of 13.
And when you come back to the United States, does this feel like a foreign land to you?
I come as a tourist. I come as a guest. I love coming back to America. It's the land of opportunity. It's the greatest place in the world to shop.
yes, it is.
Americans probably don't realize how cheap America is, respective to the rest of the world, especially places like Israel. So I enjoy coming back here. But Israel is my home.
Mm. And we're almost out of time here, but looking at the United States from Israel, how do you understand this relationship between these two countries? It's so complicated.
It is very complicated, but there are no better friends in the world than Israel and the United States, and it's important to note that the current administration, President Obama, has tightened the relationship with the government of Israel and the security establishments of Israel and the United States more than any other previous president, including George W. Bush. And yet the image of Obama in the American Jewish community and in Israel as not being friendly to Israel simply doesn't meet the test of reality.
But don't friends tell friends, in a sense, the truth?
That's right. Good
true
friends
friendship.
Don't let their friends drive drunk. And here, instead of taking the wheel away, we have the Americans seeming to give the Israelis a bigger and more powerful car.
Mm. Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Gershon Baskin has been our guest, and he is founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, a columnist for the Jerusalem Post. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about our program. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page, you can check out what our guest looks like. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.